This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
My name is Mary Ann Spitz, and I'm 14 years old. My mother has a defense job, so I do the marketing for our family. Every morning, Mother says to me, Mary Ann, be sure you buy the most for the least money. So lately, I've been buying all the Victory food specials. These are marked with a red, white, and blue basket sign with a big red V. The reason I always look for this sign is, well, you have heard the old saying, an army travels on its stomach. I know Uncle Sam needs lots of food to feed our fighting men. An army that's going places has to have good things to eat. Now, steak fried rare with French fried potatoes is my favorite meal. But I'd rather have a soldier eat this dinner than eat it myself, if it will get this war over sooner. So, if you have friends or relatives in the armed forces, think twice before you buy the food they need. Look for the Victory specials and help win the war faster.
Hi, this is Gary Clinton. I just wanted to pop in here real quickly and tell you two things. The first is August the 19th, 1942. That was when this episode of Suspense first aired. The second is, we got a tight show here, so I'm just going to shut up for most of the rest of this hour. But there's no real promises for the second hour. Enjoy.
Play theater of outstanding thrillers, produced and directed by William Speer and scored by Bernard Herrmann. The notable melodramas from fiction and stage and screen, from the world's great literature of entertaining excitement, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense. Tonight's adventure in suspense is from the pen of Dorothy Sayers. She called it The Cave of Ali Baba. Like the tale told by Scheherazade, a distinguished ancestress in the storytelling art, Miss Sayers' thriller deals with 40 thieves and with two magic words. For your uneasy listening, then, Suspense presents The Cave of Ali Baba. On a Saturday afternoon in January, in the grim and narrow house in Lambeth, a man sat eating kippers and reading the daily paper. He was smallish and spare, with brown hair rather too regularly waved and a strong, brown, pointed beard. His double-breasted navy blue suit, his socks, tie, and handkerchief were all scrupulously matched, and his brown boots just a trifle too highly polished. He did not look a gentleman, not even a gentleman's gentleman. Yet there was something about his appearance which suggested that he was accustomed to the manner of life in good families. Superior butler, perhaps, yet not old enough to be retired. A footman who had come into a legacy, yes. He had just finished eating, and he was sipping his coffee when a slight noise at the front door caught his ear. Swiftly. Too swiftly for a quiet little man sitting eating kippers and reading his paper on a Saturday afternoon. He sprang up, he dashed through the small hallway, and he flung the door open.
Of course, no one in sight. The society is at least dramatic in its delivery of its correspondence.
And as if he knew what he would find, he shut the door and turned to the hat stand in the hall. An envelope had been placed there. It was addressed to Joseph Rogers. So Mr. Rogers opened the note.
Number 21. An extraordinary general meeting will be held tonight at the house of Number 1 at 11:30. You will be absent at your peril. The word is finality. Finality. Yes, I think so.
The man called Joseph Rogers stood for a moment studying the note. Then he strode to the rear of the house, to a tall safe built in the wall. Carefully, he manipulated a dial. He swung the safe door open. He stepped inside, into a small strong room. He opened a drawer marked correspondence, placed the note inside, and then came out again. A moment to reset the lock for a new combination, and then he went back into the living room. He reached for the telephone. He lifted it from the cradle and then reconsidered. Too dangerous. He hurried upstairs and clambered into an attic. In the furthest corner, he searched for and found a knot hole in the woodwork. He pressed it. A concealed trapdoor swung open, and he was in the loft of the adjoining house. He paused before three cages, in each of them a carrier pigeon. Carefully, he wrote a note. Slipped it under a pigeon's wing.
There you are, my pretty. There, take it easy now. There you go. Lie straight. 4:30. I'll send another pigeon at 5 and the third at 6. I should have my answer by 9:30 at the latest. Oh, I forgot one thing, most important.
Mr. Rogers moved through the trapdoor, back into the attic of his own house, and once again he stood before the tall safe built in the wall. He opened the door, stepped into the strong room, moved for a moment quietly in the dark, and then spoke gently.
Now, be good, my sweetheart. I'm depending on you. Open sesame. Come on now, old thing. Open sesame. Open sesame. That's better. That's very much better.
By 9:30, his answer was back. All the little piece of paper said was a hasty okay. At a quarter before 11, he took his revolver from a locked drawer, inspected it carefully. Yes, loaded it with cartridges from an unbroken packet, and left the house. He walked quickly, keeping well away from the wall. And when he climbed on a bus, he sat next to the conductor, where he could watch all who got on and off. By 25 minutes after 11, he was out on lonely Hampstead Heath, pausing in the shadow of a large tree to adjust a black velvet mask, on which, in white thread, was stitched the number 21. Then he stepped briskly to the door of the villa that lay before him and...
What is it?
Finality.
Come in. Go right on through. Number one will check you in.
Right. Twenty-one, sir.
Lift your mask. Very well, 21. You may go on to the meeting room.
Thank you, sir.
The room of the villa in which Mr. Rogers now stood was a large one, a brilliantly lighted room. There's a gramophone in one corner blaring out a jazz tune. To its rhythm, couples, masked men and women, were dancing. Some were in evening dress, some in tweeds and jumpers. In another corner of the room was the bar. Mr. Rogers went up to it and asked the masked man in charge for a double whiskey. He consumed it slowly, leaning on the bar. The room filled. Presently, someone moved across to the gramophone and stopped it. Mr. Rogers looked around. Number one, the massive gentleman in evening dress who had checked him in, appeared on the threshold. A tall woman in black stood beside him. Her mask, embroidered with a white number two, covered her hair and her face completely. Only her fine bearing, her white arms, and her dark eyes, shining through the eye slits, proclaimed her as a woman of power, a physical attraction. The masked dancers were silent now as number one spoke.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are short two members tonight. I need not inform you of the disastrous failure of our plan for obtaining the plans of the court Windlesham Heliscoper. Our courageous and devoted friends, number 15 and number 38, were betrayed and taken by the police. Some of you might fear that under examination these two would break down and give away our society. There is no need for such a fear. I gave the usual orders, and their tongues have been silenced. Their defense will be discreetly compensated in the usual manner. I call upon number 12 and 34 to undertake this agreeable task. They will attend me at my office for their instructions after the meeting. Will the numbers I have named kindly signify by raising their hands that they are able and willing to perform this duty? Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your partners for the next dance.
The gramophone struck up again. Mr. Rogers turned to a girl near him in a red dress. She nodded, and they slipped into the movement of a foxtrot. The couples gyrated solemnly and in silence. Their shadows were flung against the blinds as they turned and stepped to and fro. The girl in red spoke to Mr. Rogers.
What's happened? I'm frightened, don't you? I feel as if something awful was about to happen.
It does take one a bit short. Number one's way of doing things. But it's safer like that.
Oh, those poor men.
No talk in phrase. You know the rules.
Sorry.
In silence, the dance continued. And then it came to an end. And then when it had finished, the dancers came again to where number one sat and waited with tense eagerness for him to speak.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may wonder why this extraordinary meeting has been called. The reason is a serious one. The failure of our recent attempt was no accident. The police were not on the premises that night by accident. We have a traitor amongst us. This last failure was not the first. You'll remember the unfortunate way in which the affair of the Dinglewood pearls turned out. And there were others. However, I am happy to say that our minds can now be easy. All these troubles have been traced to their origin. The offender has been discovered and will be removed. The misguided member who introduced the traitor to our ranks will be placed in a position where his lack of caution will have no further ill effects. There's no cause for alarm. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your partners for the next dance.
Again, the gramophone took up its bizarre monotony, and the masked dancers glided and turned. And their movements were sharper, more staccato. The girl in red was claimed by a tall mask in evening dress. A hand laid on Mr. Rogers' arm made him start. A small, plump woman in a green jumper slipped a cold hand into his. The dance went on. When it stopped, everyone stood detached, stiffened in expectation. The endless interval was over. Number one raised his voice.
Ladies and gentlemen, you will no doubt wish to be relieved of the questions on your mind. I will name the persons involved. Number 37.
No, no.
Silence.
Oliver.
I swear, Oliver.
Silence.
You have failed in discretion. You will be dealt with. If you have anything to say in defense of your folly, I'll hear it later. Sit down.
Number 37 sank down upon a chair. He pushed his handkerchief under the mask to wipe his face. Two tall men closed in upon him. The rest fell back.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will now name the traitor. Stand forward. Number 21. Take off your mask. Number 37. This man was introduced to our society by you under the name of Joseph Rogers, formerly second footman in the service of the Duke of Denver, dismissed for petty thievery. Did you take steps to verify the statement?
I did. I did, as God my witness. It was all straight.
I had him identified by two of the servants. I asked all over about him. The story was true. I'll swear it was.
Number 21. Your name has been given as Joseph Rogers. Is that your real name? Answer me. Is that your real name?
No.
What is your name?
Peter Death Breddon Whimsy.
Silence! My compliments, your lordship. We thought Lord Whimsy was dead. He was killed, so the paper said, 2 winters ago while shooting big game in Africa. He even left a will, proved of £500,000.
To his mother, I believe, the Dowager Duchess of Denver.
Lord Peter Whimsy, indeed. Well-known book collector, man about town, distinguished criminologist. Took an active part in the solution of several famous mysteries.
Taking an active part, if you don't mind.
So you deliberately led us to think you were dead and became Joseph Rogers to gain entrance to our society. What has become of the real Joseph Rogers?
He died abroad. I took his place.
And the end of your impersonation to uncover our society?
Precisely.
I see. The robbery of your own fete, on which we congratulated ourselves, and which you helped to execute, was arranged.
Obviously.
The robbery of the Duchess, your mother, was arranged by you.
It was. It was a very ugly tiara, no real loss to anybody with decent taste.
The burglary of the Winthrop Mansion, the theft of the necklace at Covent Garden, the others as well. You arranged them all.
All. May I spoke, by the way?
You may not. Numbers 15, 22, 39. You have watched the prisoner. Has he made any attempt to communicate with anybody?
None. His letters and parcels have been opened. His telephone tapped and his movements followed. Even the water pipes in his house have been under observation for Morse code signals.
You're certain?
Absolutely.
Then we may be sure that he has been alone in this adventure. Well, ladies and gentlemen, please take your... Very well. Take the prisoner away. And be sure you explain carefully to him first the manner of his death. I'm sure he'll enjoy it.
Wait, at least you can let me die decently.
Take him away.
Stop, I have something to say, something to sell.
We make no bargains with traitors.
No, but listen. Do you think I haven't thought of this? I'm not a fool. I've left a letter.
To whom?
To the police. If I don't return tomorrow, it'll be open.
It's a bluff. The prisoner sent no letter. He's been strictly watched for months.
I left the letter before I came to Lambeth.
Then it can't contain no information of any
value. Oh, but it does. The combination of my safe.
Indeed? Has this man's safe been searched?
Yes. What did it contain? No information of importance, sir. An outline of our organization, the name of the house, nothing that can't be altered and covered before morning.
And did you investigate the inner compartment of the safe?
You hear what he says, did you?
He's trying to bluff. There is no inner compartment.
I hate to contradict you, but I'm really afraid you must have overlooked it.
And what did you say was in the compartment, if it does exist?
The names of every member of this society with their addresses, photographs, and fingerprints.
How did you say you contrived to get this information?
By doing a little detective work on my own.
But you've been watched.
True, the fingerprints of my watches adorn the first page of the collection.
That statement can be proved?
Certainly. The name of number 40, for example...
Stop! If you mention names here, you will certainly have no hope of mercy. Bring the prisoner to my office. Ladies and gentlemen, take your partners for the next dance. Yes,
prove that I know your gang from number 1 through number 25. Do you want me to prove that I know the others as well?
My lord, your story fills me with regret that you are not, in fact, a member of our society. Wit, courage, and industry are valuable in an association like ours. I fear I cannot persuade you. No, I suppose not.
Yes?
Ask the members kindly to proceed to the supper room. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll not conceal from you the seriousness of the situation. The prisoner has recited to me 25 names and addresses which were thought to be unknown except to their owners and to me. There has been great carelessness. Fingerprints have been obtained. He showed me some photographs of them. He tells me that the book of names and addresses is to be found in the inner compartment of his safe, together with certain letters and papers stolen from the houses of members and several objects with fingerprints. I believe he tells the truth. He offers the combination of the safe in exchange for a quick death. I think his offer should be accepted. What is your opinion, ladies and gentlemen?
The combination is known already.
Fool!
This man is Lord Peter Wimsey, a scientist of crime. Do you think he will have forgotten to change the combination?
Oh, I say give him the promise. Time's getting short.
Yes. You agreed?
Yes.
It's a bargain, Wimsey. What is the combination?
The word of the combination is unreliability.
And the inner door, the inner compartment.
In anticipation of the visit of the police, the inner door is open.
Good. Number 12 and 36. You will go to the prisoner's house and...
Why should any more members...
That's right.
I agree. Nobody ought to be trusted.
Then what, ladies and gentlemen, do you suggest?
You go yourself. You're the only one that knows all the names. You go yourself.
I second that motion.
Is the wish of the meeting, then, that I should go?
No. I say no. No, don't go. Number one is our president, the head and soul of our society. If anything should happen to him, where should we be? You've all blundered. We have your carelessness to thank for all this. Do you think we should be safe for 5 minutes if he were not here to repair your folly?
Well, there's something in that.
If you will pardon my suggesting it, the lady appears to be in a position peculiarly favorable for the reception of the president's confidences. The contents of my modest volume will be no news to her. Why should she not go herself?
Because I say she must not. If it is the will of the meeting, I'll go. Give me the key of the house.
Here.
Is your horse watched?
No.
If I have not returned in 2 hours, act for the best to save yourselves. And do what you like with the prisoner.
The president has been gone 2 hours. Traitor! What's happened to him?
How should I know? Perhaps he's looked after himself and gone while the going was good.
Liar! Oh. He'd never do that. What have you done with him? Speak, or I'll make you speak.
I can only form a guess, madam. I'm afraid that your president may quite inadvertently have left the door of the inner compartment closed behind him, in which case...
Yes.
Well, let me explain the mechanism of my safe. Hmm? The inner compartment has 2 doors. The outermost most opens outward with an ordinary key.
Oh, do you think that the prisoner is so stupid as to be caught in an obvious trap? Undoubtedly, he will have wedged open that inner door.
Undoubtedly, madam. But the sole purpose of that inner door is to appear to be the only one. Hidden behind the hinge of that door is another, sliding panel, also left open. Inside the compartment is the big, heavy ledger containing all the information about this society. This ledger lies on a steel shelf. Do I make myself clear?
Oh, yes, go on.
The steel shelf is balanced on a concealed spring. When the weight of the book, the ledger, is lifted, the shelf rises almost imperceptibly, and in rising it makes an electrical contact. Now, let me draw a picture. Your president steps into the inner compartment, sees the book, takes it up, anxiously to examine to see if it's the right one. The shelf rises, the electrical contact is made, and the steel panel behind him slides into place. He's trapped.
You devil! What is the word that opens the inner door? Quick, the word.
Do you remember the story of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves?
Uh-huh.
Well, when I had this safe constructed, my mind went back, well, call me sentimental if you will, to my childhood. The words that open the door are open sesame. Oh.
How long can a man live in this devil's trap of yours?
Oh, I should think he might hold out for a few hours if he didn't use up all the oxygen by hammering and yelling. I imagine if we go there at once, we'd be able to get him out all right.
I'll go myself.
I think you'd better take me with you.
Why?
Well, I'm the only person who can open the door.
But you've given me the word.
Yes, you have the word. But this door of mine, I'm rather proud of it. You know, it's my own invention. It's the latest thing. It will open to the words, open sesame, all right. But to my voice only.
Your voice? I'll choke your voice in my hands. What do you mean, your voice only?
Don't clutch my throat like that. You'll wreck my voice, and then the door might not recognize it. That's better. The door got stuck for a week once, and when I had a cold.
Is what he says true? Is it possible?
Perfectly possible, madam. It'll have a microphone arrangement. Could be done also with light vibrations.
We must let him go. Take the ropes off him.
Let him go? Nothing. He doesn't go to blab to the police. The president's done in, that's all. And we'd all better make traps while we can. It's all up, boys.
Right. Chuck his fella down the cellar and fasten him in. I'll go and destroy the ledgers. 32, you know where the switch is. Give us a quarter of an hour to clear, then you can blow the place to glory.
No. No, you can't leave one to die. He's your president, your leader. I won't let it happen. I won't. I'll free this man myself.
Here, none of that.
Let me go. Let go of me.
Think, Lester, think. It'll be light in an hour or two. The police may be here at any moment.
The police? Oh, yes. Yes, you're right. No, we mustn't imperil the safety of all for just one man. He himself would not wish it. Throw this man in the cellar and let's get out of here while there's time.
Here. This is good enough. Leave him here.
Right.
Let's go.
Hey, you chaps.
Yeah, should have got him.
I say, it's lonesome down here in this cellar. You might at least leave the light on.
Don't worry about the dark. They're taking you here as the time fuse for the bomb that's going to blow out this place. It's all set. You won't have long to wait.
Not long.
Who is it? Who's there?
Shh. Go still. So I can cut the ropes.
Well, it isn't two. My compliments, madam, on your loyalty to your president.
Quick, quick. They've set the time fuse. The house is mine. Follow me as fast as you can. Number one must be saved. And only you can do it.
Well, how did you manage to?
There's no time for questions. Get up and follow me. You will release him. You promise.
I promise. But I warn you, madam, that this house is surrounded. When my safe door closed, it gave a signal to Scotland Yard. All the members of the society are taken.
Never mind them. Here, outside. Quick.
All right, who's there?
Is that you, Inspector? Get your fellows away, quick. The house is going up in a minute. Yeah, I'm a bit winded. What's happened, Inspector?
Well, about half a dozen of them got blown up. The rest we bagged.
Hurry, we must hurry.
Who's this?
Oh, one of the gang. She's called number two.
We must save him. We must.
Golly, I came forgot the gentleman in the safe. Parker, where's your car?
It's down the lane.
Send one of your men down to get it.
Right. Johnson, bring that car here.
Yes, sir.
I've got the number one of the whole company quietly asphyxiating at home. I promised we'd get back and save him. He's the bloke that we've been wanting. The man at the back of the Morrison case and the Hope Wilmington case and hundreds of others.
Is this it? Quite a contraption.
Yes, I only hope he hasn't upset the adjustment by something like it.
Oh, please, Alice.
I hope you haven't heard my voice.
Oh, you sound all right.
I can only be conversational. Come on, old thing. Show us your faces.
Open sesame. Open sesame. Open sesame. Open sesame.
Let me see. No, he's not.
He lived to stand his trial.
Thank you.
This is Barry Kroger, and
this is the Columbia Broadcasting.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon.
Mysterious Traveler.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back and get a good grip on your nerves. If you can. Where are we going? We're going to call on Edward Farrington and his three sisters, a little family of four who love each other devotedly, and whose story I call The Symphony of Death. Edward Farrington and his sisters live by themselves in a large, gloomy old house on the outskirts of Boston. It is evening, and Edward is on his way home when his attention is attracted by a small establishment which is advertising a close-out sale. An economical and foresighted man, Edward stops his car and enters the dimly lighted shop.
Good evening, sir. May I serve you?
I'm not sure. I saw your sign, and it occurred to me that by purchasing now, something I'm sure to need sooner or later, I might save a substantial sum.
You are very foresighted, sir. Now, here is a design I can recommend unreservedly. A simple white column, yet cut from the finest Carrara marble.
I see.
The angel on top is of a single piece with a shaft. It can never be dislodged or separated. In every inch, in every line, it expresses dignified grief.
Yes, I agree with you, but I'm afraid it's too expensive. What are these stones here in the corner?
These? They are our simplest design. Polished granite cubes with just enough room for the name and the date. They are excellent memorials, but I am sure in the long run you will get greater satisfaction from something more appealing to the eye.
No, I think these will do excellently. Yes, they're just what I had in mind. I'm particularly pleased by the fact that they're all alike.
I see. You wish all four of them, then?
No, not four, just three. Three will quite prepare me for all eventualities. Will you be able to store them for me until they're needed?
Yes, we can store them at our main warehouse, if you wish.
Excellent. I suppose I might as well give you the inscriptions to be carved on them while I'm here. You can leave room for the dates to be added.
Of course, sir.
Then if you'll just take this down. In loving memory of Florence, sister of Edward Farrington.
Yes, sir.
In loving memory of Martha, sister of Edward Farrington. In loving memory of Emily, sister of Edward Farrington.
Is that you?
Yes, Emily.
Oh, you're all wet.
Yes, it's beginning to rain.
Let me help you with your coat, Edward. I'll hang it up for you.
Now, Emily, please don't fuss over me this way. It makes me nervous to be poured at.
But I just want to help you with your coat.
I can hang it up by myself.
Emily, is that Edward? Oh, Edward, you're late. We were worried about you.
I'm here, and I'm perfectly all right, Florence, as you can see. Now, is dinner ready?
Oh, yes, Edward. Martha has everything ready. Martha, Edward's home.
What? Oh, it's you, Edward. Well, we were worried about you.
Martha, I've told you not to worry if I'm a few minutes late.
Well, I suppose we just can't help it, Edward. Now we'll eat. And perhaps after dinner you will play the piano for us.
Oh, will you, Edward?
Please, say yes.
Please, Edward.
Well, we'll see. I really should work on my symphony tonight, but perhaps I can play for a few minutes after dinner.
And so, after dinner, Edward played for his sisters on the great piano in the library. Emily and Florence crowded close to him as he played, and Martha, busy with her knitting, sat and watched them with fond gaze.
Oh, that was lovely, Edward.
Please play some more.
Yes, something we can sing.
Well, all right, just one more and that's all. It's just thunder. You mustn't jump like that. It can't hurt you.
I know, but I can't help it.
I like thunderstorms. I like to watch the lightning.
I think that's enough for tonight. Now off to bed, both of you.
All right. Good night, Edward. Good night, Edward.
Good night, Emily, Florence.
Well, I suppose I might as well go to bed myself.
No, Martha, don't go yet. I want to talk to you.
To me?
Yes.
What about Edward?
How old are you?
How old? I'm 35. Oh, no, why be silly about it? I'm 37.
You ought to get married. You still could, and you owe it to yourself.
I shall never marry, Edward. I promised Father that I'd look after things and keep the four of us together as long as we live. And I will.
As long as we live. But perhaps we'd be better off if we weren't together.
You can't mean that.
But I do. I need solitude in which to finish my book and my symphony. It's very distracting, you know, to have the three of you constantly hovering about me.
You're just feeling blue tonight. You wouldn't be happy without us any more than we would be without you. No, we'll all be together, the four of us, as long as we all live. Well, now I'm going to bed. Good night, Edward, dear.
Good night, Martha. We'll all be together, the four of us, as long as we live. As long as we all live.
In the morning, it was still raining. After breakfast, Edward shut himself in the library to continue work on his symphony.
Haven't Edward played well, Emily?
Edward's a wonderful player. Let's listen a minute before we go upstairs.
Do you think he'd really mind if we went in? If we just sat very quiet?
I don't think so. We'll be very quiet.
Who's there? Oh, it's you two.
We're sorry, Edward. We didn't mean to disturb you.
We'll go right away.
No, you don't have to go.
You mean we can stay, Edward?
For a minute. I'm going to stop for a smoke.
I'll bring you the cigarette. Oh, the cigar box is empty.
Empty? Why, I was positive I had plenty of cigarettes. That's why I didn't buy any yesterday.
You did have a lot yesterday. I saw them.
Well, they're gone now. Then I suppose I'll have to drive down the hill to the drugstore and get some more. And that will mean I'll get nothing done this morning. Nothing whatever. I wish I had someone I could send for them.
Edward, let me go for you.
In this rain? Why, you'd get soaking wet, Florence.
Wait, I could take the car.
Take the car in weather like this?
But I'm a good driver, Edward. You once said so yourself. And I have a driver's license.
You know I have you help me get here.
Yes, that's true.
Well, I'd be very careful, Edward.
Well, you must promise to drive very slowly down the hill to town.
Oh, I will, Edward.
All right, then, Florence. Here's the key to the car. The old car, of course. Now, be very careful.
Oh, I will. I promised I will. May I stay and listen until Florence comes back?
Well, I suppose so, seeing you're here already.
You don't like us to be around, do you? Sometimes I think you don't like us at all anymore.
Oh, that's nonsense. It's just that I'm trying to get a great piece of music written, and you keep disturbing me.
Oh, there goes Florence in the car now. She's going fast. Florence likes to go fast, and then step on the brakes.
She promised to be careful.
I know, but she forgets.
Well, I'm sure she'll be all right. Now I must get to work.
Oh, that was nice.
Well, I'm perfectly comfortable, Martha. I don't need a jacket.
You mustn't take chances. Here, put it on.
Oh, all right.
What? Is she up there? Oh, no. She's gone to get Edward some cigarettes.
Gone out? In this rain?
Edward, let her take the car.
Edward, you didn't.
Martha, please don't get excited. She can drive, and she promised to be careful.
But you promised never to let her drive alone. You know how she drives unless someone's with her.
Really, she's a better driver than you think. There's nothing to be alarmed about. She'll be back any minute, and then...
I'll answer it.
No, it's probably for me. I'll answer it. Hello? Yes, this is Mr. Farrington. The police.
Edward, what is it?
Hush, Martha. What about my sister? She did what? All right. Yes. Yes, of course. I'll be right down.
Edward, what is it? What's happened to Florence?
Martha, we must all be very calm. Florence has had a terrible accident.
No!
The brakes of the car apparently gave way at the bottom of the hill. Florence ran off the curb and crashed into the rocks there. She was killed instantly.
The official investigation into poor Florence's death established only the fact that the brakes had failed. But the brakes had only been checked the day before, as Edward proved to the police. Accordingly, they ascribed death to an unfortunate mechanical failure and closed the case. Edward, however, could not dismiss it from his mind so easily.
Edward, you can't go on like this day after day, brooding about poor Florence's death.
Oh, my dear, I blame myself for it. If I hadn't let her take the car.
I know, Edward. Why don't you try to work on your symphony? It'll help take your mind off Florence.
No, I can't possibly do any work on that yet for a while. No, but I have another notion. I think I'd like to write our family history.
Oh, family history?
Yes. And it seems to me that once, in Mother's old trunk in the attic, I saw a lot of letters that were written to her by relatives. Are they still there?
Why, yes, they are.
And I'd like to look them over. They might help me get started on my history. Will you show me where they are, Martha?
Why, yes, of course. We'll go up to the attic and I'll get them out for you right after lunch. Here are the letters, Edward. Mother wrote a lot of letters those last few years. After the doctor said she must never leave the house.
Yes, I remember. How quiet and dark it is up here in the attic. Mm. We used to play hide-and-go-seek here, the four of us.
Yes. Until Mother died.
I've often wondered about that. She fell from one of these attic windows, I remember. She was leaning out, looking at the river, and she slipped.
Yes. It was that window there. The one looking down into the courtyard.
I'd like to look at it. Oh, the catch is stuck. Will you help me open it, Martha?
Well, all right.
There. almost 50 feet down to the courtyard. She was killed instantly, wasn't she?
Yes. But let's close it now.
In a moment. Martha, did Mother really slip and fall, or did she throw herself out?
What makes you ask that?
I was only 8 at the time, but it seems to me Mother was wandering badly in her mind there at the end. And then I recollect hearing Father say something about an asylum to Uncle George.
Edward, you mustn't say that ever again. It would terrify Emily.
But it's true, isn't it?
Yes, it's true. Poor Mother.
It's strange you calling her Mother because she wasn't really your mother.
No, but I always think of her as Mother. I was only 2 when Father married her.
Poor creature. Let's believe that she slipped. It would be easy to slip from this window, wouldn't it?
Well, the sill isn't very low.
Yes, but lean out a little farther and see how easy it would be. No, a little farther. You see how overbalanced one becomes?
Yes, yes, you're right. Now, help me back, Edward.
Of course. Martha, catch yourself. Martha!
Poor Martha's tragic death, coming so soon after Florence's, was a great shock to Emily and Edward. But Edward recovered from the tragedy somehow after a few weeks, and as though determined not to let it upset him, spent many hours a day at his beloved piano, working on his projected masterpiece.
That was wonderful. You played just like you used to, before Florence and Martha died.
Yes, I'm getting my old touch back.
You don't mind my coming in to listen, do you?
Not today, but Emily, you have been disturbing me these last few weeks. Must you follow me around all the time?
But Edward, you know how much I like to be near you. And now that Florence and Martha are gone, I haven't anyone else to talk to.
Yes, I know that, but I can't get any work done unless I'm left in peace.
I won't bother you anymore, I promise. You know, I do miss Florence and Martha.
Of course you do.
But just the same, it's been awfully nice having you all to myself since they went.
I'm afraid it's very lonely for you.
Oh, no, it isn't. I like it.
Yes, but I think we'll have to get a housekeeper. She'd be company for you and she'd look after things. In fact, I'm going into town to interview a housekeeper today, a Mrs. McDonald. You'd like to go with me, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, Edward.
We'll take the car and have a nice drive at the same time.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Now, how would you like to go out and get the car started for me?
Get the car started?
Yes, I have to tend to a few things before we go, and the motor needs to warm up. It's not working very well.
Oh, Edward, do you think I could start it?
Of course you could. Just turn on the switch and step on the starter, and then let it run until it's good and warm.
All right, Edward. May I have the key?
Yes. Here you are. Now, this is the ignition key.
Mm-hmm.
And use the little side door to get in. I'll unlock the big doors when I come out.
I can pretend I'm driving it. Will you be long?
No, just sit in the car and wait until I come.
All right, Edward.
Here I am, Emily. I took longer than I expected. I hope you haven't been sitting here with the motor running all this time. Emily! Emily!
With Emily's unfortunate death from carbon monoxide poisoning, Edward Farrington was left quite alone in the great old house. His neighbors saw little of him, though they could hear him at his piano for many hours each day. They knew, however, that a week after Emily's funeral, he hired a housekeeper, Mrs. McDonald, to take charge of the house for him.
Now, Mrs. McDonald, this is your first day, and before you start, I'd like to explain a few things to you.
Of course, Mr. Farrington.
As you know, I've suffered the tragic loss of all my sisters in the past few months.
Oh, yes, sir. A great sorrow it must have been. But they do say tragedies come in threes.
Indeed, they seem to. But I'm sure I'll be quite comfortable now with you to look after me.
I surely hope so, sir.
I'm certain of it. Now, I'm a rather moody man, and I'm working upon some music for which I have great hopes.
Yes, sir.
Above all else, I wish to be left alone. I do not want to be disturbed. Is that understood?
Quite, Mr. Farrington.
You may call me at mealtimes. At all other times, I prefer that you do not even enter this part of the house.
I understand.
Good. That's all, I think. Just put up with my little oddities, and we'll get along very well.
Yes, sir. Then I'll see about the ordering for dinner now, sir, if you'll excuse me.
Now, let me see. The second movement needs touching up, so perhaps I'd better... What is it, Mrs. McDonald? I thought I said I was never to be disturbed.
I'm very sorry, sir, but there's a gentleman come to see you. It's Detective Barnes, sir, from the police.
From the police? Am I to be bothered with more stupid questions? Well, show him in. I suppose I must see him.
Yes, sir. Will you go in, sir?
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Farrington. You remember me, I think.
Yes, yes, Mr. Barnes, I remember you. In view of the number of ridiculous and unnecessary questions you asked me after the death of my poor sisters, I have good reason to remember you.
I've come to ask you more questions, Mr. Farrington. Tell me, did your sister Emily have a driver's license?
I really don't know, and I don't care.
You should care. Listen to me. First, your sister Florence died in an auto accident when brakes that had just been inspected failed to work.
Even modern automobiles aren't proof against mechanical failure.
Then Martha died in a fall from an attic window. Her body landed in the courtyard a full 6 feet from the wall of
well,
the house.
Well, what of that?
It was much too far away for her to strike. Unless she leaped or was pushed. And you had said she didn't leap.
I repeated, she did not leap, she fell.
Perhaps. Now we come to Emily. She died of carbon monoxide poisoning in a closed garage.
Well?
You have said it happened because she went to get the car out to drive you downtown. That was your statement under oath.
And a perfectly accurate statement.
But I have just learned from the neighbors that Emily didn't know how to drive a car.
What? Well, of course she could.
Furthermore, they say her mental condition was such she could never learn to drive.
Well, perfectly absurd.
Did she have a driver's license?
I repeat, I do not know.
Because if she didn't, your statement is false. And if any part of your statement proves false, Mr. Farrington, I trust I make my meaning clear.
Mr. Barnes, you can't show one jot of evidence to back up your ridiculous suspicions. Any court in the land would laugh at you for them.
I can show no direct evidence. But there is such a thing as circumstantial evidence.
You haven't even any circumstantial evidence.
I have a world of it. The brakes on your car failed. And you are an amateur mechanic.
Well?
Martha's body falling so far from the building that she must have been pushed.
Mere conjecture.
Finally, Emily dying in a car she couldn't drive. Though you have said she was going to drive you downtown.
And she was. You've done nothing but build a tissue of fantastic suspicions.
A jury will take them more seriously. Especially when they learn that just before the first death, you bought 3 tombstones. One for each of your sisters. That shows what you were planning.
It shows nothing. It was a sale. I was merely being foresighted.
Then, Mr. Farrington, why didn't you buy 4 stones? One for each of you.
I refuse to discuss the point. There was no reason for me to kill my sisters.
No normal reason, perhaps. Though now that you are alone, you are living very comfortably on the income from your father's estate.
Indeed.
Furthermore, Mr. Farrington, I have checked on your family history. I know the truth about your unfortunate mother.
Well?
The fact concerning her might cause the jury to look differently upon you. It might influence the jury to bring in a verdict of murder while of unsound mind.
Get out. Get out of this house, do you hear? You can prove nothing. Nothing whatsoever.
All right, Mr. Farrington. I'm going. But I'll be back.
No. Wait. I'm ill. Help me.
Here. That's it.
It's my heart. There's medicine in my desk drawer. There. A small bottle.
In the desk here?
Yes.
Here's the blue bottle. Is this it?
Yes. Hurry. There's water in the thermos jug.
Yes, I have it. Here's the water and a pill. Swallow it.
Yes, thank you. That's better. The pain's going away.
Then, Mr. Farrington, I'll be on my way. I warn you, I'm going to check as to whether Emily had a driver's license. Today is Sunday, so it may take me a few hours. But if I find she had no license, I'm going to return with a warrant for your arrest.
No, there's no need for that. Of course, the poor simpleton had no driver's license. I should have thought of that. I should have thought of that.
Then you admit you killed her.
Certainly I did. Why shouldn't I? She annoyed me. Me, a genius.
I'm afraid a jury won't care whether you're a genius or not, Mr. Farrington.
Do you suppose I care what a jury thinks? A genius is not answerable to the laws that bind other people.
The law does not agree with you.
The law? What do I care for the law? You think you've trapped me, don't you? But you haven't. You hear, you haven't.
I think I have, Mr. Farrington.
You fool. No one is going to put Edward Farrington in an asylum. No one. In a minute, I'll be beyond your reach.
What do you mean?
I mean that tablet you so obligingly got for me is a deadly poison. Poison that I bought months ago. You and your circumstantial evidence. You're never going to get a chance to use... Never... get a chance to blacken my name? But Detective Barnes...
Yes? What is it?
Promise me one thing. Promise me you won't let them bury me with my sisters.
This is the mysterious traveler again. Did you enjoy our little visit with Edward Farrington and his three loving sisters? You know, perhaps Edward made a mistake after all when he didn't buy a fourth tombstone. By the way, do you live in a gloomy old house with three sisters who love you so much you can't bear to have them near you? If you do, I'd advise you not to be too drastic with them. You might find yourself buried right beside them, as Edward was.
I know another man.
Oh, you're getting off here. Well, I'm sorry. But I'm sure we'll meet again.
I take this same train every week at this same time.
You've just heard The Mysterious Traveler, a series of dramas of the strange and terrifying. But before we tell you of next week's exciting story, here is Maurice Tarplin, the mysterious traveler himself, with a brief but vital message from your government.
You all know that the stories we tell on this program are just stories, designed to entertain you, but not to be taken too seriously. Well, what I have to say now, however, is not a story, and is deadly serious. All over the world, people are starving. The United States and other food-producing nations are fighting a battle against famine. To win, food stocks must be conserved. You can help conserve them by canning and preserving food for your own use. If you have a victory garden, put up as much as possible from it. When your local markets feature an abundance of fruits or vegetables suitable for home preservation, can or preserve a winter's supply, and release that much commercially canned food for the starving. Conserve your sugar for canning purposes. Follow the wartime rule of 1 pound of sugar to 4 quarts of finished fruit. And be sure to use only safe, tested methods. If you want information on any phase of home food preservation, write to the United States Department of Agriculture, Washington 25, D.C.
Thank you, Maurice Tarplin. In addition to Maurice Tarplin, today's cast included Eric Dressler, Hester Sondergaard, Ann Tiemann, Inga Adams, and Martin Wolfson. Original music was played by Doc Whipple. The Mysterious Traveler is written and directed by Bob Arthur and David Cogan. The The Mysterious Traveler is presented by the Mutual Network from our New York studios. Russ Dunbar speaking. The Mutual Broadcasting System.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back. The Mysterious Traveler that we just heard was originally broadcast on September the 8th of 1946. It turns out that the team of Robert Arthur Jr., David Kogan, and the actor Maurice Talpin was extremely successful for both the Mutual Broadcasting System and the radio station WOR. Between 1944 and 1952, The Mysterious Traveler would become one of the 16 highest-rated radio programs of their era, with WOR and the Mutual Broadcasting System taking great pride in putting together a program that could rival the radio giants of CBS, ABC, and NBC. During its heyday, The Mysterious Traveler spawned several similar thriller programs, such as The Strange Dr. Weird, which you've heard here, The Sealed Book, which I think you will eventually hear, Dark Venture, and Murder by Express. As you will remember, we started the evening with an episode from Suspense. The Cave of Alibaba was based on one of the short stories by Dorothy Sayers, The Adventurous Exploits of the Cave of Alibaba. Dorothy Sayers, although she doesn't really get the respect of an Agatha Christie, was a very important writer of mysteries in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. If you drop by the website, you'll find an entire Lord Peter Wimsey audiobook. In fact, it's the first Lord Peter book, Whose Body, which was published in 1922. In addition to the audiobook at the website, you'll also find links for a couple of entire novels, The Unpleasantness at the Bologna Club and Murder Must Advertise, in both ebook format and PDF format. In order to find this, you go to www.nighttransmissions.com, one word, no space between the night and the transmissions. Go to the show notes for show 31. Look at the bottom, and you'll find the links there. The next thing on the agenda is a short story from the LibriVox Project. I wish I knew for sure how to pronounce that, but even the readers of the individual stories tend to pronounce it a little differently. It's either LibriVox or LibriVox. Don't even know exactly what it means. I read somewhere where somebody claimed that it is the kind of word that one would invent if one didn't know Latin at all. It seems like the general agreement is that it means book voice, voice of the book. Well, whatever it means, we have a reading of Harry Harrison's 1958 short story, Arm of the Law. If you know Harry Harrison, you're probably kind of pleased right now, thinking, oh, I hope I haven't heard this one. Well, even if you have, stay tuned. If you haven't, it's the story of the first robot cop who takes up his duty on Mars. Some science fiction has been criticized as being space opera. That is, a Western essentially set in space, on some distant planet. And it's to some degree true of some stories. I don't think that it's actually a criticism. There are lots of good horse operas, and there's lots of good space opera. This is more like a Untouchables in Space. Harry Harrison has one quality that's sort of rare for people who are featured on this show. He's still alive. As I speak, in the fall of 2009, Harry is alive, living in Ireland at the ripe age of 84. He's a pretty well-respected science fiction writer, having written a number of series, Bill the Galactic Hero, the To the Stars trilogy. He's probably most famous for the Stainless Steel Rat series. It's certainly the best-selling of them all. And the Death World series. By the way, if you drop by the website, which I mentioned earlier, you'll find a PDF and e-book version of Harrison's 1960 novel, Death World. It's worth a read. I certainly remember liking it back in 1960 when I was 14. Harrison writes with a somewhat wry and amused cadence. Generally, his protagonists prefer the use of their brains and native intelligence to brute force to win the day. However, most of the time it does seem that in order to resolve whatever problem they're dealing with, they resort to brute force. Anyway, as I said, here is
Arm of the Law by Harry Harrison. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Reading by Greg Marguerite. Arm of the Law by Harry Harrison. At one time, this was before the robot restriction laws, they even allowed them to make their own decisions. It was a big, coffin-shaped plywood box that looked like it weighed a ton. This brawny type just dumped it through the door of the police station and started away. I looked up from the blotter and shouted at the trucker's vanishing back. "What the hell is that?" "How should I know?" he said as he swung up into the cab. "I just deliver. I don't x-ray 'em. It came in on the morning rocket from Earth is all I know." He gunned the truck more than he had to and threw up a billowing cloud of red dust. "Jokers," I growled to myself. "Mars is full of jokers." When I went over to look at the box, I could feel the dust grate between my teeth. Chief Craig must have heard the racket because he came out of his office and helped me stand and look at the box. "Think it's a bomb?" he asked in a bored voice. "Why would anyone bother, particularly with a thing this size and all the way from Earth?" He nodded agreement and walked around to look at the other end. There was no sender's address anywhere on the outside. Finally, we had to dig out the crowbar and I went to work on the top. After some prying, it pulled free and fell off. That was when we had our first look at Ned. We all would have been a lot happier if it had been our last look as well. If we had just put the lid back on and shipped the thing back to Earth. I know now what they mean about Pandora's box. But we just stood there and stared like a couple of rubes. Ned lay motionless and stared back at us. "A robot," the chief said. "Very observant. It's easy to see you went to the police academy." "Ha ha. Now find out what he's doing here." I hadn't gone to the academy, but this was no handicap to my finding the letter. It was sticking up out of a thick book in a pocket in the box. The chief took the letter and read it with little enthusiasm. "Well, well, United Robotics have the brainstorm that robots correctly used will tend to prove invaluable to police work. They want us to cooperate in a field test. Robot enclosed is the latest experimental model, valued at 120,000 credits. We both looked back at the robot, sharing the wish that the credits had been in the box instead of it. The chief frowned and moved his lips through the rest of the letter. I wondered how we got the robot out of its plywood coffin. Experimental model or not, this was a nice-looking hunk of machinery. A uniform navy blue all over, though the outlet cases, hooks, and such were a metallic gold. Someone had gone to a lot of trouble to get that effect. This was as close a robot could look to a cop in uniform without being a joke. All that seemed to be missing was the badge and gun. Then I noticed the tiny glow of light in the robot's eye lenses. It had never occurred to me before that the thing might be turned on. There was nothing to lose by finding out. "Get out of that box," I said. The robot came up smooth and fast as a rocket, landing 2 feet in front of me and whipping out a snappy salute. "Police Experimental Robot Serial Number XB0456934B, reporting for duty, sir." His voice quivered with alertness, and I could almost hear the humming of those taut cable muscles. He may have had a stainless steel hide and a bunch of wires for a brain, but he spelled rookie cop to me just the same. The fact that he was man height with 2 arms, 2 legs, and that painted-on uniform helped. All I had to do was squint my eyes a bit, and there stood Ned, the rookie cop, fresh out of school and raring to go. I shook my head to get rid of the illusion. This was just 6 feet of machine that Boffins and Brain Boys had turned out for their own amusement. "Relax, Ned," I said. He was still holding the salute. "At ease. You'll get a hernia of your exhaust pipe if you stay so tense. Anyways, I'm just the sergeant here. That's the chief of police over there." Ned did an about-face and slid over to the chief with that same greased lightning motion. The chief just looked at him like something that sprang out from under the hood of a car, while Ned went through the same report routine. "I wonder if it does anything else besides salute and report," the chief said while he walked around the robot, looking it over like a dog with a hydrant. "The functions, operations, and responsible courses of action open to the police experimental robots are outlined on pages 1842213 of the manual." Ned's voice was muffled for a second while he half-dived back into his case and came up with the volume mentioned. "A detailed breakdown of these will also be found on pages 1035-1267 inclusive." The chief, who has trouble reading an entire comic page at one sitting, turned the 6-inch-thick book over in his hands like it would maybe bite him. When he had a rough idea of how much it weighed and a good feel of the binding, he threw it on my desk. "Take care of this," he said to me as he headed towards his office, "and the robot, too. Do something with it." The chief's span of attention never was great, and it had been strained to the limit this time. I flipped through the book, wondering. One thing I never have had much to do with is robots, so I know just as much about them as any Joe in the street, probably less. The book was filled with pages of fine print, fancy mathematics, wiring diagrams, and charts in 9 colors, and that kind of thing. It needed close attention, which attention I was not prepared to give it at the time. The book slid shut, and I eyed the newest employee of the city of Nineport. "There's a broom behind the door. Do you know how to use it?"
"Yes, sir."
"In that case, you will sweep out this room, raising as small a cloud of dust as possible at the same time." He did a very neat job of it. I watched 120,000 credits worth of machinery making a tidy pile of butts and sand and wondered why it had been sent to Nineport. Probably because there wasn't another police force in the solar system that was smaller or more unimportant than ours. The engineers must have figured this would be a good spot for a field test. Even if the thing blew up, nobody would really mind. There would probably be someone along someday to get a report on it. Well, they had picked the right spot, all right. Nineport was just a little bit beyond nowhere. Which, of course, was why I was there. I was the only real cop on the force. They needed at least one to give an illusion of the wheels going around. The chief, Alonzo Craig, had just enough sense to take graft without dropping the money. There were 2 patrolmen, one old and drunk most of the time, the other so young the only scar he had was the mark of the A-tram. I had 10 years on a Metropolitan Force Earthside. Why I left is nobody's damn business. I have long since paid for any mistakes I made there by ending up in Nineport. Nineport is not a city, it's just a place where people stop. The only permanent citizens are the ones who cater to those on the way through, hotel keepers, restaurant owners, gamblers, barkeeps, and the rest. There is a spaceport, but only some freighters come there, to pick up the metal from some of the mines that are still working. Some of the settlers still came in for supplies. You might say that Nineport was a town that just missed the boat. In 100 years, I doubt if there will be enough left sticking out of the sand to even tell where it used to be. I won't be there either, so I couldn't care less. I went back to the blotter. 5 drunks in the tank, an average night's haul. While I wrote them up, Fats dragged in the 6th one. "Locked himself in the ladies' john at the spaceport and resisting arrest," he reported. "D&D, throw him in with the rest." Fats steered his limp victim across the floor, matching him step for dragging step. I always marveled at the way Fats took care of drunks, since he usually had more under his belt than they had. I have never seen him falling down drunk, or completely sober. About all he was good for was keeping a blurred eye on the lockup and running in drunks. He did well at that. No matter what they crawled under or on top of, he found them, no doubt due to the same shared natural instincts. Fats clanged the door behind number 6 and weaved his way back in. "What's that?" he asked, peering at the robot along the purple beauty of his nose. "That is a robot. I have forgotten the number his mother gave him at the factory, so we will call him Ned. He works here now." "Good for him. He can clean up the tank after we throw the bums out." "That's my job," Billy said, coming in through the front door. He clutched his nightstick and scowled out from under the brim of his uniform cap. It is not that Billy is stupid, just that most of his strength has gone into his back instead of his mind. "That's Ned's job now, because you have a promotion. You are going to help me with some of my work." Billy came in very handy at times, and I was anxious that the Force shouldn't lose him. My explanation cheered him, because he sat down by Fats and watched Ned do the floor. That's the way things went for about a week. We watched Ned sweep and polish until the station began to take on a positively antiseptic look. The chief, who always had an eye out for that type of thing, found out that Ned could file the odd ton of reports and paperwork that cluttered his office. All this kept the robot busy, and we got so used to him we were hardly aware he was around. I knew he had moved the packing case into the storeroom and fixed himself up a cozy sort of robot dormitory coffin. Other than that, I didn't know or care. The operation manual was buried in my desk, and I never looked at it. If I had, I might have had some idea of the big changes that were in store. None of us knew the littlest bit about what a robot can or cannot do. Ned was working nicely as a combination janitor-file clerk and should have stayed that way. He would have, too, if the chief hadn't been so lazy. That's what started it all. It was around 9 at night, and the chief was just going home when the call came in. He took it, listened for a moment, then hung up. "Greenback's liquor store. He got held up again. Says to come at once." "That's a change. Usually we don't hear about it until a month later. What's he paying protection money for if China Joe ain't protecting? What's the rush now?" The chief chewed his loose lip for a while, finally and painfully reached a decision. "You better go around and see what the trouble is." "Sure," I said, reaching for my cap, "but no one else is around. You'll have to watch the desk until I get back." "That's no good," he moaned. "I'm dying from hunger, and sitting here isn't going to help me any." "I will go take the report," Ned said, stepping forward and snapping his usual well-greased salute. At first, the chief wasn't buying. You would think the water cooler came to life and offered to take over his job. "How could you take a report?" he growled, putting the wise guy water cooler in its place. But he had phrased his little insult as a question, so he had only himself to blame. In exactly 3 minutes, Ned gave the chief a summary of the routine necessary for a police officer to make a report on an armed robbery or other reported theft. From the glazed look in Chief's protruding eyes, I could tell Ned had quickly passed the boundaries of the chief's meager knowledge. "Enough," the harried man finally gasped. "If you know so much, why don't you make a report?" Which to me sounded like another version of, "If you're so damn smart, why ain't you rich?" which we used to snarl at the brainy kids in grammar school. Ned took such things literally, though, and turned towards the door. "Do you mean you wish me to make a report on this robbery?" "Yes," the chief said, just to get rid of him, and we watched his blue shape vanish through the door. "He must be brighter than he looks," I said. "He never stopped to ask where Greenback's store is." The chief nodded, and the phone rang again. His hand was still resting on it, so he picked it up by reflex. He listened for a second, and you would have thought someone was pumping blood out of his heel from the way his face turned white. "The holdup's still on," he finally gasped. "Greenback's delivery boy is on the line, calling back to see where we are. Says he's under a table in the back room." I never heard the rest of it because I was out the door and into the car. There were 100 things that could have happened if Ned got there before me. Guns could go off, people hurt, lots of things. And the police would be to blame for it all, sending a tin robot to do a cop's job. Maybe the chief had ordered Ned there, but clearly, as if the words were painted on the windshield of the car, I knew I would be dragged into it. It never gets very warm on Mars, but I was sweating. Nineport has 14 traffic regulations, and I broke all of them before I had gone a block. Fast as I was, Ned was faster. As I turned the corner, I saw him open the door of Greenback's store and walk in. I screamed brakes in behind him and arrived just in time to have a gallery seat. A shooting gallery at that. There were two hold-up punks, one behind the counter making like a clerk, and the other lounging off to one side. Their guns were out of sight, but blue-coated Ned bursting through the door was too much for their keyed-up nerves. Up came both guns like they were on strings, and Ned stopped dead. I grabbed for my own gun and waited for pieces of busted robot to come flying through the window. Ned's reflexes were great, which I suppose is what you should expect of a robot. "Drop your guns, you are under arrest." He must have had on full power or something. His voice blasted so loud my ears hurt. The result was just what you might expect. Both torpedoes let go at once, and the air was filled with flying slugs. The show windows went out with a crash, and I went down on my stomach. From the amount of noise, I knew they both had recoilless 50s. You can't stop one of those slugs. They go right through you and anything else that happens to be in the way. Except they didn't seem to be bothering Ned. The only notice he seemed to take was to cover his eyes. A little shield with a thin slit popped down over his eye lenses. Then he moved in on the first thug. I knew he was fast, but not that fast. A couple of slugs jarred him as he came across the room, but before the punk could change his aim, Ned had the gun in his hand. That was the end of that. He put on one of the sweetest hammerlocks I've ever seen and neatly grabbed the gun when it dropped from the limp fingers. With the same motion that slipped the gun into a pouch, he whipped out a pair of handcuffs and snapped them on the punk's wrists. Hold up Nick number two was heading for the door by then, and I was waiting to give him a warm reception. There was never any need. He hadn't gone halfway before Ned slid in front of him. There was a thud when they hit that didn't even shake Ned, but gave the other a glazed look. He never even knew it when Ned slipped the cuffs on him and dropped him down next to his partner. I went in, took their guns from Ned, and made the arrest official. That was all Greenback saw when he crawled out from behind the counter, and it was all I wanted him to see. The place was a foot deep in broken glass and smelled like the inside of a Jack Daniels bottle. Greenback began to howl like a wolf over his lost stock. He didn't seem to know any more about the phone call than I did, so I grabbed a hold of a pimply-looking kid who staggered out of the storeroom. He was the one who had made the calls. It turned out to be a matter of sheer stupidity. He had worked for Greenback only a few days and didn't have enough brains to realize that all holdups should be reported to the protection boys instead of the police. I told Greenback to wise up his boy, as look at the trouble that got caused. Then pushed the two ex-holdup men out to the car. Ned climbed in back with them, and they clung together like two waifs in a storm. The robot's only response was to pull a first aid kit from his hip and fix up a ricochet hole in one of the thugs that no one had noticed in the excitement. The chief was still sitting there with that bloodless look when we marched in. I didn't believe it could be done, but he went two shades whiter. "You made the pinch?" he whispered. Before I could straighten him out, a second and more awful idea hit him. He grabbed a handful of shirt on the first torpedo and poked his face down. "You with China Joe?" he snarled. The punk made the error of trying to be cute, so the chief let him have one on the head with the open hand that set his eyes rolling like marbles. When the question got asked again, he found the right answer. "I never heard from no China Joe. We just hit town today and..." "Freelance. By God." The chief sighed and collapsed into his chair. "Lock him up and quickly tell me what in hell happened." I slammed the gate on them and pointed a none-too-steady finger at Ned. "There's the hero," I said. "Took them on single-handed, wrestled them for a fall, and made the capture. He's a one-robot tornado, a power for good in this otherwise evil community. And he's bulletproof, too." I ran a finger over Ned's broad chest. The paint was chipped by the slugs, but the metal was hardly scratched. "This is going to cause me big trouble. Big trouble," the chief wailed. I knew he meant with the protection boys. They did not like punks getting arrested and guns going off without their okay. But Ned thought the chief had other worries and rushed in to put them right. "There will be no trouble. At no time did I violate any of the robotic restriction laws. They are part of my control circuits and therefore fully automatic. The men who drew their guns violated both robotic and human laws when they threatened violence. I did not injure the men, merely restrained them." It was all over the chief's head, but I like to think I could follow it, and I had been wondering how a robot, a machine, could be involved in something like law application and violence. Ned had the answer to that one, too. "Robots have been assuming these functions for years. Don't recording radar meters pass judgment on human violation of automobile regulations? A robot alcohol detector is better qualified to assess the sobriety of a prisoner than the arresting officer. At one time, robots were even allowed to make their own decisions about killing. before the robotic restriction laws, automatic gun pointers were in general use. Their final development was a self-contained battery of large anti-aircraft guns. Automatic scan radar detected all aircraft in the vicinity. Those that could not return the correct identifying signal had their courses tracked and computed. Automatic fuse cutters and loaders readied the computer-aimed guns, which were fired by the robot mechanism. There was little I could argue about with Ned, except maybe his college professor vocabulary, so I switched the attack. But a robot can't take the place of a cop. It's a complex human job. Of course it is, but taking a human policeman's place is not the function of a police robot. Primarily, I combine the functions of numerous pieces of police equipment, integrating their operations and making them instantly available. In addition, I can aid in the mechanical process of law enforcement. If you arrest a man, you handcuff him, but if you order me to do it, I have made no moral decision. I am just a machine for attaching handcuffs at that point. My raised hand cut off the flow of robotic argument. Ned was hipped to his ears with facts and figures, and I had a good idea who would come off second best in any continued discussion. No laws had been broken when Ned made the pinch, that was for sure. But there are other laws than those that appear on the books. China Joe is not going to like this. Not at all, the chief said, speaking my own thoughts. The law of tooth and claw. That's one that wasn't in the law books. And that was what ran Nineport. The place was just big enough to have a good population of gambling joints, bawdy houses, and drunk rollers. They were all run by China Joe, as was the police department. We were all in his pocket, and you might say he was the one who paid our wages. This is not the kind of thing, though, that you explain to a robot. Yeah, China Joe. I thought it was an echo at first, then realized that someone had eased in the door behind me. Something called Alex, 6 feet of bone, muscle, and trouble, China Joe's right-hand man. He imitated a smile at the chief, who sank a bit lower in his chair. China Joe wants you should tell him why you got smart cops going around and putting the arm on people and letting them shoot up good liquor. He's mostly angry about the hooch. He says that he had enough, Guff, and after this you should... I am putting you under robot arrest pursuant to Article 46, Paragraph 19 of the Revised Statutes. Ned had done it before we realized he had even moved. Right in front of our eyes he was arresting Alex and signing our death warrants. Alex was not slow. As he turned to see who had grabbed him, he had already dragged out his cannon. He got one shot in, square against Ned's chest, before the robot plucked the gun away and slipped on the cuffs. While we all gaped like dead fish, Ned recited the charge in what I swear was a satisfied tone. The prisoner is Peter Rakyomsky, alias Alex the Axe, wanted in Canal City for armed robbery and attempted murder, also wanted by local police of Detroit, New York, and Manchester on charges of... Get it off me! Alex howled. We might have, too, and everything might have still been straightened out if Benny Bug hadn't heard the shot. He popped his head in the front door just long enough to roll his eyes over our little scene. Alex! They're putting the arm on Alex! Then he was gone, and when I hit the door, he was nowhere in sight. China Joe's boys always went around in pairs, and in 10 minutes he would know all about it. Book him, I told Ned. It wouldn't make any difference if we let him go now. The world has already come to an end. Fats came in then, mumbling to himself. He jerked a thumb over his shoulder when he saw me. What's up? I see little Benny Bug coming out of here like the place was on fire and almost get killed driving away. Then Fats saw Alex with the bracelets on and turned sober in 1 second. He just took a moment to gape, then his mind was made up. Without a trace of stagger, he walked over to the chief and threw his badge on the desk in front of him. I am an old man, and I drink too much to be a cop. Therefore, I am resigning from the force. Because if that is whom I think it is over there with the cuffs on, I will not live to be a day older as long as I am around here. Rat, the chief growled in pain through his clenched teeth, deserting the sinking ship. Rat. Squeak, Fats said, and left. The chief was beyond caring at this point. He didn't blink an eye when I took Fats' badge off the desk. I don't know why I did it. Perhaps I thought it was only fair. Ned had started all the trouble, and I was just angry enough to want him on the spot when it was finished. There were 2 rings on his chest plate, and I was not surprised when the badge pin fitted them neatly. There. Now you're a real cop. Sarcasm dripped from the words. I should have realized that robots are immune to sarcasm. Ned took my statement at face value. This is a very great honor, not only for me but for all robots. I will do my best to fulfill all the obligations of the office. Jack Armstrong in tin underwear. I could hear the little motors in his guts humming with joy as he booked Alex. If everything else hadn't been so bad, I would have enjoyed that. Ned had more police equipment built into him than Nineport had ever owned. There was an ink pad that snapped out of one hip, and he efficiently rolled Alex's fingertips across it and stamped them on a card. Then he held the prisoner at arm's length while something clicked in his abdomen.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
Then he held the prisoner at arm's length while something clicked in his abdomen. Once more sideways, and two instant photographs dropped out of a slot. The mug shots were stuck on the card, arrest details and such inserted. There was more like this, but I forced myself away. There were more important things to think about, like staying alive. "Any ideas, Chief?" A groan was my only answer, so I let it go at that. Billy, the balance of the police force, came in then. I gave him a quick rundown. Either through stupidity or guts, he elected to stay, and I was proud of the boy. Ned locked away the latest prisoner and began sweeping up. That was the way we were when China Joe walked in. Even though we were expecting it, it was still a shock. He had a bunch of his toughest hoods with him, and they crowded through the door like an overweight baseball team. China Joe was in front, hands buried in the sleeves of his long Mandarin gown. No expression at all on his ascetic features. He didn't waste time talking to us, just gave the word to his own boys. "Clean up this place. The new police chief will be here in a while, and I don't want him to see any bums hanging around." It made me angry. Even with the graft, I like to feel I'm still a cop, not on a cheap punk's payroll. I was also curious about China Joe, had been ever since I tried to get a line on him and never found a thing. I still wanted to know. "Ned, take a good look at that Chinese guy in the rayon bathrobe and let me know who he is." My, but those electronic circuits work fast. Ned shot the answer back like a straight man who had been rehearsing his lines for weeks. "He is a pseudo-Oriental utilizing a natural sallowness of the skin heightened with dye. He is not Chinese. There has also been an operation on his eyes, scars of which are still visible. This has been undoubtedly done in an attempt to conceal his real identity, but Bertillon measurements of his ears and other features make identity positive. He is on the very wanted list of Interpol, and his real name is..." China Joe was angry, and with reason. "That's the thing. That big-mouth tin radio set over there. We heard about it, and we're taking care of it." The mob jumped aside then, or hit the deck, and I saw there was a guy kneeling in the door with a rocket launcher. Shaped anti-tank charges, no doubt. That was my last thought as the thing let go with a whoosh. Maybe you can hit a tank with one of those things, but not a robot. At least, not a police robot. Ned was sliding across the floor on his face when the back wall blew up. There was no second shot. Ned closed his hand on the tube of the bazooka, and it was so much old drainpipe. Billy decided that anyone who fired a rocket in a police station was breaking the law, so he moved in with his club. I was right behind him since I did not want to miss any of the fun. Ned was at the bottom somewhere, but I didn't doubt he could take care of himself. There were a couple of muffled shots, and someone screamed. No one fired after that, because we were all too tangled up. A punk named Brooklyn Eddie hit me on the side of the head with his gun butt, and I broke his nose all over his face with my fist. There is a kind of fog over everything after that, but I do remember it was very busy for a while. When the fog lifted a bit, I realized I was the only one still standing, or leaning, rather. It was a good thing the wall was there. Ned came in through the street door carrying a very bashed-looking Brooklyn Eddie. I hoped I had done all that. Eddie's wrists were fastened together with cuffs. Ned laid him gently next to the heap of thugs, who I suddenly realized all wore the same kind of handcuffs. I wondered vaguely if Ned made them as he needed them, or had a supply tucked away in a hollow leg or something. There was a chair a few feet away, and sitting down helped. Blood was all over everything, and if a couple of the hoods hadn't groaned, I would have thought they were corpses. One was. I noticed suddenly a bullet had caught him in the chest. Most of the blood was probably his. Ned burrowed in the bodies for a moment and dragged Billy out. He was unconscious, a big smile on his face, and the splintered remains of his nightstick still stuck in his fist. It takes very little to make some people happy. A bullet had gone through his leg, and he never moved while Ned ripped the pants leg off and put on a bandage. The spurious China Joe and one other man escaped in a car, Ned reported. Don't let it worry you, I managed to croak. Your batting average still leads the league. It was then I realized the chief was still sitting in his chair where he had been when the brouhaha started, still slumped down with that glazed look. Only after I started to talk to him did I realize that Alonzo Craig, chief of police of Nineport, was now dead. A single shot, small caliber gun, maybe a .22, right through the heart, and what blood there had been was soaked up by his clothes. I had a good idea where the gun would be that fired that shot. A small gun, the kind that would fit in a wide Chinese sleeve. I wasn't tired or groggy anymore, just angry. Maybe he hadn't been the brightest or most honest guy in the world, but he deserved a better end than that, knocked off by a two-bit racket boss who thought he was being crossed. Right about then I realized I had a big decision to make. With Billy out of the fight and Fats gone, I was the Nineport police force. All I had to do to be clear of this mess was to walk out the door and keep going. I would be safe enough. Ned buzzed by, picked up two of the thugs, and hauled them off to the cells. Maybe it was the sight of his blue back, or maybe I was tired of running. Either way, my mind was made up before I realized it. I carefully took off the chief's gold badge and put it on in place of my old one. The new chief of police of Nineport, I said to no one in particular. Yes, sir, Ned said as he passed. He put one of the prisoners down long enough to salute, then went on with his work. I returned the salute. The hospital meat wagon hauled away the dead and wounded. I took an evil pleasure in ignoring the questioning stares of the attendants. After the doc fixed the side of my head, everyone cleared out. Ned mopped up the floor. I ate 10 aspirin and waited for the hammering to stop so I could think what to do next. When I pulled my thoughts together, the answer was obvious. Too obvious. I made as long a job as I could of reloading my gun. Refill your handcuff box, Ned. We are going out. Like a good cop, he asked no questions. I locked the outside door when we left and gave him the key. Here. There's a good chance you'll be the only one left to use this before the day is over. I stretched the drive over to China Joe's place just as much as I could, trying to figure if there was another way of doing it. There wasn't. Murder had been done, and Joe was the boy I was going to pin it on, so I had to get him. The best I could do was stop around the corner and give Ned a briefing. This combination bar and dice room is the sole property of he whom we will still call China Joe until there's time for you to give me a rundown on him. Right now, I got enough distractions. What we have to do is go in there, find Joe, and bring him to justice. Simple? Simple, Ned answered in his sharp Joe College voice. But wouldn't it be simpler to make the arrest now when he is leaving in that car instead of waiting until he returns? The car in mention was doing 60 as it came out of the alley ahead of us. I only had a glimpse of Joe in the back seat as it tore by us. Stop them! I shouted, mostly for my own benefit since I was driving. I tried to shift gears and start the engine at the same time and succeeded in doing exactly nothing. So Ned stopped them. It had been phrased as an order. He leaned his head out of the window and I saw at once why most of his equipment was located in his torso, probably his brain as well. There sure wasn't much room left in his head when that cannon was tucked away in there. A 75 recoilless. A plate swiveled back right where his nose should have been if he had one, and the big muzzle pointed out. It's a neat idea when you think about it, right between the eyes for good aiming, up high, always ready. The boom boom almost took my head off. Of course, Ned was a perfect shot, so would I be with a computer for a brain. He had holed one rear tire with each slug, and the car flapped to a stop a little ways down the road. I climbed out slowly while Ned sprinted there in seconds flat. They didn't even try to run this time. What little nerve they had left must have been shattered by the smoking muzzle of that 75 poking out from between Ned's eyes. Robots are neat about things like that, so he must have left it sticking out deliberately. Probably he had a course in psychology back in robot school. Three of them in the car, all waving their hands in the air like the last reel of a Western, and the rear floor covered with interesting little suitcases. Everyone came along quietly. China Joe only snarled while Ned told me that his name really was Stanton, and the Elmira hot seat was kept warm all the time in hopes he would be back. I promised Joe Stanton I would be happy to arrange it that same day, thereby not worrying about any slip-ups with the local authorities. The rest of the mob would stand trial in Canal City. It was a very busy day. Things have quieted down a good deal since then. Billy is out of the hospital and wearing my old sergeant's stripes. Even Fats is back, though he is sober once in a while now and has trouble looking me in the eye. We don't have much to do because, in addition to being a quiet town, this is now an honest one. Ned is on foot patrol nights and in charge of the lab and files days. Maybe the policeman's benevolent wouldn't like that, but Ned doesn't seem to mind. He touched up all the bullet scratches and keeps his badge polished. I know a robot can't be happy or sad, but Ned seems to be happy. Sometimes I would swear I can hear him humming to himself, but of course that's only the motors and things going around. When you start thinking about it, I suppose we set some kind of precedent here, what with putting on a robot as a full-fledged police officer. No one ever came around from the factory yet, so I have never found out if we're the first or not. And I'll tell you something else. I'm not going to stay in this broken-down town forever. I have some letters out now looking for a new job. So some people are going to be very surprised when they see who their new chief of police is.
This is a LibriVox recording. The Hidden Beast by J.D. Beresford. His house is the last in the village. Towards the forest the houses become more and more scattered, reaching out to the wild of the wood, as if they yearn to separate themselves from the swarm that clusters about the church and the inn. And his house has taken so long a stride from the others that it is held to the village by no more than the slender thread of a long footpath. Yet the house is set with its face towards us, and has an air of resolutely holding on to the safety of our common life, as if dismayed at its boldness in swimming so far, it had turned and desperately grasped the lifeline of that footpath. He lived alone, a strange man, surly and reticent. Some said he had a sinister look, and on those rare occasions when he joined us at the inn, after sunset, he sat aside and spoke little. I was surprised when, as we came out of the inn one night, he took my arm and asked me if I would go home with him. The moon was at the full, and the black shadows of the dispersing crowd that lunged down the street seemed to gesticulate an alarm of weird dismay. The village was momentarily mad with the clatter of footsteps and the noise of laughter, and somewhere down towards the forest a dog was baying. I wondered if I had not misunderstood him. As he watched my hesitation, his face pleaded with me. "There are times when a man is glad of company," he said. We spoke little as we passed through the village toward the silences of his lonely house, but when we came to the footpath he stopped and looked back. "I live between two worlds," he said. "The wild and..." He paused before he rejected the obvious antithesis, and concluded, "the restrained." "Are we so restrained?" I asked, staring at the huddle of black and silver houses clinging to the refuge on the hill. He murmured something about a compact, and my thoughts turned to the symbol of the chalk-white church tower that dominated the honeycomb of the village. "The compact of public opinion," he said more boldly. My imagination lagged. I was thinking less of him than of the transfiguration of the familiar scene before me. I did not remember ever to have studied it thus under the reflections of a full moon. An echo of his word, differently accented, drifted through my mind. I saw our life as being in truth compact, little and limited. He took up his theme again when we had entered the house and were facing each other across the table, in a room that looked out over the forest. The shutters were unfastened, the window open, and I could see how, on the further shore of the wastelands, the light feebly ebbed and died against the black cliff of the wood. "We have to choose between freedom and safety," he said. "The individual is too wild and dangerous for the common life. He must make his agreement with the community, submit to become a member of the people's body. But I..." He paused and laughed. "I have taken the liberty of looking out of the back window." While he spoke, I had been aware of a sound that seemed to come from below the floor of the room in which we were sitting. And when he laughed, I fancied that I had heard the response of a snuffling cry. He looked at me mockingly across the table. "It's an echo from the jungle," he said. "Some trick of reflected sound. I can always hear it in this room at night." I shivered and stood up. I prefer the safety of our common life, I told him. It may be that I have a limited mind and am afraid, but I found my happiness in the joys of security and shelter. The wild terrifies me. A limited mind, he commented. Probably it is rather that you lack a fire in the blood. I was glad to leave him, and he, on his part, made no effort to detain me. It was not long after this visit of mine that the people first began to whisper about him in the village. At the beginning they brought no charge against him, talking only of his strangeness and of his separation from our common interests. But presently I heard a story of some fierce wild animal that he caged and tortured in the prison of his house. One said that he had heard it screaming in the night, and another that he had heard it beating against the door. And some argued that it was a threat to our safety, since the beast might escape and make its way into the village. And some that such brutality, even though it were to a wild animal, could not be tolerated. But I wondered inwardly whether the affair were any business of ours, so long as he kept the beast to himself. I was a member of the council that year, and so took part in the voting when presently the case was laid before us. But no vote of mine would have helped him if I had dared to overcome my reluctance and speak in his favor. For whatever reservations may have been secretly withheld by the members of the council, they were unanimous in condemning him. We went, six of us, in full daylight to search his house. He received us with a laugh and told us that we might seek at our leisure. But though we sought high and low, peering and tapping, we found no evidence that any wild thing had ever been concealed there. And within a month of the day of our search, he left the village. I saw him alone once before he went, and he told me that he had chosen for the wild and freedom, that he could no longer endure to be held to the village even by the thread of the footpath. But he did not thank me for having allowed the search of his house to be conducted by daylight, although he knew that I at least was sure no echo of the forest could be heard in that little room of his, save in the transfigured hours between the dusk and the dawn.
And with that, so ends the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. And so for the remaining few minutes together, I'm going to play a little bit of music.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, made of brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the guy with the drum. Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Als sie durch die Schöne Deutschland gehen, meine Gesang wird sie hören. Ist ein kleiner Melodie in Deutschland für 15 oder 20 Jahre. Als sie durch die Schöne Deutschland.
As you travel through the Schöne Deutschland,
meine Gesang,
a melody will greet your ear. It's a melody that's been around in Deutschland for 15 to 20 years.
Each and every German dances to the strain of the I Was Not a Nazi polka. All without exception join in the refrain of the I Was Not a Nazi polka. Getting buzz and crazy, they bought the tune before.
Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka.
We are that the Dachau was just a nice resort.
Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka. The German is so cultured, he does not like to fight. The peaceful life is what he most enjoys. For years the German people were utterly convinced. IG Farm and manufacture children's toys. I never shot a Luger or goosed a single step. Sing me, I was not a Nazi polka. Sing me, I was not a Nazi polka. I was not a Nazi polka.
Was you not an SS guard?
I was not an SS guard.
I was not a Nazi polka.
Did you not love Ilse Koch?
I did not love Ilse Koch.
I was not a Nazi polka.
Did you not despise the Jews?
I did not. Some of my best friends.
I was not a Nazi polka.
Did you not think Adolf great?
I did not. Adolf who?
Adolf who?
Ja, Adolf who?
Fritz, you're putting me on.
Was bedeutet dieser putting me on?
Are you kidding me or something?
Nein, I'm not kidding you. Adolf who?
Adolf Hitler.
Should I know him? Is he a folk singer?
You don't remember.
No, I don't remember him. Who was he?
Well, a little man, very mean, very loud and brash.
Mm-mm.
Not too tall, he never smiled. Wore a black mustache.
Nein, I never
heard. He had a girl. Eva Brown, hair as red as flame.
Yeah, yeah.
He papered walls for many years,
yeah.
Till his moment
of
came.
Of course, he's the one that clapped his hands, bent into a dance.
Yeah.
When the news came to him that we had conquered France,
that's him.
He once said that our flag proudly must unfurl.
Yeah.
Today in Germany,
yeah.
Tomorrow the world. I never heard of it.
Neither did I.
To our Israeli allies, let us raise a toast. Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka.
Sure there was some Nazis, two or three at most.
Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka. We tried to throw out Hitler right from the very start. That's what every history book should tell. We hated Heinrich Himmler, Martin Bormann too. We believe as Sherman did that war is hell. Germans are as gentle as flowers in the spring. Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka. Germans are a people who love to dance and sing. Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. You there, you are not singing. You do not like to sing. Tell me, you still have a family in Germany, nicht wahr? Sing.
Sing the I Was Not a Nazi polka. Sing her!
Shenandoah, I long to see you. Oh,
Take you away.